John, we got a special guest. You got a special guest. Thankfully, you were in Houston. You saw him face to face, and we've been circling him for a while. We finally got him, Reggie Jackson.
Yeah, I had two great conversations with Reggie in Houston. Didn't get enough of Reggie. You can never have too much Reggie. Not only 563 home runs, but a very smart man. I'm interested to see what he has to say about Major League Baseball, the Astros, the Yankees, and anything else that should come up.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll also talk to him about the Oakland A's, past, present, great, not so great. John and I will also talk about something to open the show that's not great, the number of pitching injuries. We'll play hit and error at the end if you stick with us on the show with Joel Sherman and John Heyman.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
The season's begun, and unfortunately, one of the stories going into the season, there were 132 pitchers on the injured list to begin the season. It was 80% of the injured players to begin the season, and it's only gotten worse. In New York, Jonathan Loaisiga lost for the year with an elbow injury. Shane Bieber, the 2020 AL Cy Young Award winner, Yuri Perez. It's just continuing. It's bad for our sport, starting pitching in particular. It's bad that we don't know matchups going into games, and the age of the starting pitcher has died. And I just wonder how teams are going to get through this season, because it just feels like it's as bad as it's ever been. Just wonder what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I mean, they need to figure it out somehow. I suspect it is the velocity. It is the need or the feel of the need to throw 100 miles an hour or close to it. I mean, this goes on when your kids. And it seems to be too much. We used to have pitchers who threw 90 or less, were very successful. Nowadays, I guess those guys don't get drafted. I mean, would Tom Glavine not be drafted, or Greg Maddux, or would Quintana never get an offer to play? I'm not sure. I think the scouting needs to be done differently. We need to find guys who can and reward them, who can get people out and know how to pitch. And right now it's all about velocity and spin rate. And I think that's the issue. I don't think it's the pitch clock. You know, I'm not an expert. I did ask a few pitchers about the pitch clock and they didn't think it was. I don't blame the union for throwing it out there and trying everything and figuring this out somehow, because I think it needs to be figured out. But I do suspect it is the velocity.
See, could it be the pitch clock is a contributing factor? I assume it could be a contributing factor, but I think the biggest factor is you're trying to throw maximize stuff on every pitch. Unfortunately, John, you and I are old enough. We remember there was a time when no one even thought of a pitch clock. A pitcher was delivering a pitch every probably 10 or 12 seconds back in the 70s and 80s, but they weren't maximizing every pitch. I'm watching the other night, Clark Schmidt has a 6-0 lead, and not for 1 second does he think, part of my job today with a 6-0 lead is to get 6 or 7 innings here. He's still trying to throw a monster pitch on every pitch. He's walking guys, and he ends up lasting 13 outs with a 6-0 lead. And ultimately, you know, it's not feeling the environment. You know, you get your two best relievers into the game because you didn't cover it. And relievers are in the game so much, and they're getting hurt. And I just feel like it's like the pitch clock, John. The teams are not going to fix this. I do think it is up to Major League Baseball and the union, two sides that wouldn't agree that today's Monday, to come together. I think it's in the union's best interest to work and find a way out of here, because I just don't know why anyone would sign starting pitching long-term anymore. Nobody's going to make it doing it like this. You know, it's a needle in a haystack to figure out the one guy who might make it through. I think all we're going to see now is Snell contracts and Montgomery contracts and Verlander contracts and Scherzer contracts, because It's just, how would you know anyone who could give you years and years of making 30 starts?
Yeah, I mean, part of it was guys knowing how to pitch decades ago. But I do think, you know, there were probably places to rest in batting orders, you know, going back 30, 40 years. You know, there was usually the shortstop was not a hitter. Then right. We, of course, had that era with A-Rod and Jeter and all these great hitting shortstops. And now every team has a shortstop who's a threat to hit. Center field, same thing. I covered a team where Gary Pettis was the center fielder. He had one home run. You know, he was a runner. He wasn't really a hitter. And, you know, that was a while ago, obviously. But it feels like there's no rest in the batting order now. Every team, except maybe the, you know, couple at the bottom, has a tough batting order. It's more difficult for these guys to get through it. But they do need to figure something out. And I do think guys need to learn how to pitch. That's what they need to do more than try to throw 100 or throw it harder than Heel. I mean, Heel, he's throwing 97. I'm worried about him already. He's already had one Tommy John. I mean, Strider's got this injury now. He may have to need a second Tommy John. It's it's really unfortunate. It really
Hell,
is.
I'm worried about the biggest Paul problem Skeens, in the game. Right? Like, I'm worried about Paul Skeens. Like, I said to somebody the other day, John, you know, I've never seen Paul Skeens play, and I've never seen Wyatt Langford play. I'll just take Langford. Like, if he ends up being a good player, I know he's going to play every day. Skeens is throwing 102 miles an hour. I'm just not sure the body is meant to do this. We saw it with Jacob deGrom. Great athlete, great delivery, and all he does is break down because he's throwing the ball so darn hard and maximizing not just his fastball but his breaking stuff. It's unsustainable.
Right. We just saw Strasburg retire. He was a guy who was clocked at, I think, 103 or something like that as a college pitcher. I mean, he was a phenom, and he did end up having a very good career, and certainly DeGrom has had a good career, a very good career, but it's really, really unfortunate. We're never going to see a 300-game winner again, and it wasn't that long ago where we had Randy Johnson and Glavine and Maddux and guys winning 300 games. I mean, I think if you get a 200-game winner, that's like a 300-game winner. Now, it's very unfortunate. Obviously, the two top pitchers in New York, Senga and Cole, not in that order, but Cole and Senga, they're both out for now. Fortunately, it does not appear that they need Tommy John or anything like that. Senga's actually a shoulder, but that's been the number one issue in baseball, and it's really, really put a damper on the beginning of the season.
Yeah, we'll try to elevate the conversation a little. If you stick with us on the show with Joel Sherman and John Heyman, Reggie Jackson joins us next. Well, John and I can't be happier. Somebody we've known for a very long time has been nice enough to join us on the show. It's Reggie Jackson. Reggie, I thought about, like, how would I even introduce Reggie Jackson? Hall of Famer, Mr. October. Like, then I thought about, like, what's the first question you know, we could talk about the A's current. We could talk about the A's dynasty. We could talk about the Yankees current. We could talk about the Yankees dynasty you were part of. Why don't I start with where we are now? You're a special advisor to the Astros. The Astros are as close to the dynasty Yankees as we've had, seven straight ALCS. A lot of things have changed over, but they're off to a rough start. Do you think it's just a rough start and still a elite team? Or do all dynasties essentially fade at some point and you're seeing something with expert eyes that concerns you?
You know, I'm not concerned. You get to the point to where I have an understanding of the quality of the team, the quality of the players. Our organization is special. Our leadership is special. And so I know that we have a good ball club and we're going to contend in this division race again. Be us in Texas and Seattle will creep in there, if you will. But we're a 95 win team. As I look at us, we could win 101 or so. Last year, we struggled all year. We never really hit a groove. And this year, it's almost like we'll have a new player. Altuve, one of the best players in baseball, a future Hall of Famer, our leader. He missed 72 games last year. I think Aaron Judge missed maybe 50 or 60. You take those guys out of the lineup, and you, when it starts to be more than 30, then you're going to be less of a team. You have Gerrit Cole now with the Yankees. I go to the Yankees because of it's you guys are New York, and they're so relative to most of you listeners. You take Gerrit Cole. He's the best pitcher in baseball. I think last year, what is he, 15-4? Yes. You know, something like that. Yes. But, you know, the Yankees weren't 10, 12 games over 500. He was. And so when you lose that, you know, 90 and 70 becomes 80 and 80. Yuck. because of the 10 games. I look at us as a seasoned team. We're outstanding at third base. We're outstanding at shortstop. We're outstanding at second base. We're struggling offensively at first base. We've got a new catcher that's a good defender, surprisingly better for better than you would normally expect him to be for his age, with the framing and how to catch and how to call a game, et cetera. But he's an outstanding hitter. He's got a chance to be a catcher and hit 300. And then, of course, we have pretty good left fielder with Myers and McCormick and playing center and sharing that, as well as Yordan playing some left field. And then, of course, our left fielder is an all-star. I don't know how much longer we're going to have him, but and we've got really good pitching. So we'll get it straightened out. We'll get it figured out. And so I'm not really worried about our guys. I'll be back to see them Thursday of this week for about 8 or 9 days.
You know, I'm going to get more into that contemporary stuff, the Astros and the rest of the league and everything else that's going on, the pitching injuries. But the thing I want to ask you is the World Series, the three home runs. Since I was a Yankee fan, it's etched in my memory. What do you remember most about that three home run day, and how has that affected your life?
Wow. You know, John, and Joe, if I can call you Joe instead of Joel,
his dad did,
but, I just enjoyed that series so much. I was coming off a bit of a struggle, at the end of the year, and I had a great, ending that year in 77. I remember the last 50 games, I drove in like 51 runs and hit 13 homers. And we really gelled as a team. Of course, Sparky Lyle was spectacular that year. Gidby was 16-7, I want to say. Figueroa was really good that year, talking about the pitching. And then we had great bench players. We had Gamble and Pinella and Roy White playing left field. We were good. Great, really. And we had, you know, some of the best players at that position. Munson was either the best catcher in the league or was right next to Carlton Fisk. Nettles was one of the best defenders, if not the best defender at third base. Bucky Dent, shorthanded. Willie Randolph, Chambliss. I mean, we were really good. And so going back to, let me fall back into the question. I ran off the trail there a little bit. I remember the night at batting practice and getting dressed and starting the game. And I always hit last. You hit 45 minutes. You had 9 hitters. And the teams were changing the field. And the Dodgers sat on the field, sat on the ball bags, using that as a reference, and waited, kneeled down, et cetera, leaned on the batting cage because they were coming in after I hit, because I was the last guy to hit. We each hit 5 minutes. Dick Young, I remember. Dave Anderson, I remember. Murray from
– Murray Chass.
No, Murray Chass, but the big writer from the L.A. Times, Murray.
Oh, Jim Murray.
Jim Murray. All the big guys were around there. As writers, Jacobson, Steve Jacobson, Phil Pepe, Moss Klein, who hated my guts, but it was really you know the memories were etched, if you will. Lasorda is standing there, if you will, Maury Wills, et cetera, and all these guys with the Dodgers and Peter O'Malley. So I get in and you have about 45 swings in the 5 minutes. And I probably hit 35 baseballs in a 50-foot radius or 100-foot radius in right center field. I mean, it was like they were being shot out of a cannon. And I remember walking out of the cage, and I got a standing ovation from the crowd. The stadium was full. And Dick Young was there, and he coined this name of Jax, J-A-X. Jax does this because of the shortness of the Daily News. They wanted to shorten things up. So he called me J-A-X in a headline all the time. And he said, Reggie, what a tremendous exhibition. I said, you're right. I just hope I didn't leave it here. And I remember saying that to the writers of Anderson and Dick Young and Phil Pepe and all those guys that were there. Jacobson, who was my fave, him and Dave Anderson were my fave guys. And I just went into the clubhouse, and a lot of guys mentioned things to me, et cetera. And then back out on the field, I remember talking to Gene Michael. And I said, Gene, give me a little more understanding of how they're going to pitch me. And he said, Reggie, they're going to crowd you. They're going to pitch you in. And I said, OK. He said, that's how they pitched McCovey. That's how they pitched Oliver. That's how they pitched like kind guys like you, Billy Williams, et cetera. So when I got into the game, and it was pretty much, I was looking for balls. And the first time up, I got four balls. Never even got a chance to offer. Hooten walked me. And then the next time up, there was a man on. I think Thurman was on, and either he or Willie. And first pitch, fastball inside. Bam. I remember smacking it. And I remember I hit it a little on top of the ball. And I was hoping, I was running down to first base, and I said, stay up, stay up, stay up. And bam, went into about the third or fourth row like a bullet, got around that. And then next time up, I was coming up, and Lasorda had looked at me, and I think I already had three homers, because I'd hit a couple in L.A., hit a bomb on Sunday, and then I'd hit, I want to say, Messersmith or Roden to deep left center in the left center field bleachers. And so they had Elias Sosa coming in, and I kind of looked around and I said to myself, that's ball in. And this guy threw hard. He's a 95, 96 guy. First pitch in, I kind of leaned back off the plate and bam, running down the first baseline. I felt like I hit a four iron, just bam. And I knew it was gone, round and round the bases. And then next time up, I come up, I got two. And then I had recognized that I tied the most homers in a series. It was four, and I was a baseball fan, so I knew that Hank Bauer, and I knew that Duke Snyder and those guys had hit four homers in a series, and I tied them. And thought that was really cool. And I kind of looked around. I was coming up in the last time, and I went to home plate, and they were bringing in Charlie Hoff. And I'd hit homers off Wilbur Wood, Eddie Fisher. Who was the old guy that pitched until he was like 55 with the White
Sox?
Hoyt Wilhelm. I probably had 12 homers or more off knuckleballers. And I couldn't believe that they were bringing him in. And I just said to myself, God, I hope they let him come all the way in. I forgot about the rules that once you're announced, you got to face the guy. And I just said to myself, God, I hope they don't change him. I hope they just let him come in. And man, and I sat around. I kind of looked around at this. I looked around at the crowd. And I said, they can't know that I've murdered knuckleballers. And he came in the first pitch, bam, one of the longest balls I've ever hit the center field. And it's just so nice and majestic where it kind of landed in the black, bounced around like a pinball machine. And I circled the bases and will never, ever forget I remember the photograph on the back of the Daily News had me at a position in my running where both feet were off the ground as I was striding. And I said, it couldn't have been a better picture because that's how I felt. I was off the ground, you know? And so, and from there, like you said, John, I don't go anywhere too many days without somebody mentioning the three homers, et cetera. And it just seems like those three homers, and there's other guys that hit three. Ruth hit three. Pujols hit three. And the kid in San Francisco.
Sandoval.
Sandoval hit three. Theirs weren't in a row, and that weren't all three pitches. And I don't think Ruth hit his in the Yankee Stadium. I don't know where he hit him, but hitting him in Yankee Stadium against the Dodgers with Cosell and all that media between George Steinbrenner and Billy Martin and myself and Ruth and Gehrig in a history, it is something that's very, very special to me. And as you guys both know, you get mad at the Yankees. You want to yell and scream at Cashman or tell Hal to do this or that. But at the same time, you're a Yankee fan true and true. And for me, the pinstripes will always be part of who I am.
Look, John bounced a little backwards. I'm wondering if I could combine backward and forward. You were an Oakland A from 68 to 75. I think you came back for your last season in 87. You won three championships there with the A's, a dynasty team. You try to buy the team at some point. We're seeing what's happening now, Reggie. They're abandoning the city. It's not being done in the greatest form by John Fisher and his cohorts. They're going to be in Sacramento for a few years before they end up in Vegas. If everything goes well for that ownership, that's what they want to do. I wonder, as somebody with history in that city, what do you think of where we are right now?
I'm embarrassed for baseball. I feel terrible for the city. I don't know the Fisher family. Certainly, I know who they are. They're Ariat. Banana Republic. They're the Gap. And very, very successful franchises. A great family. They have an enormous art collection, if you will. That didn't mean a damn thing. But I honestly thought that they would purchase the team in the same fashion that the Levi Strauss family did, the Haas family, to save the team for the city. Being a largely populated minority city, and of course, tech has taken over a lot of the downtown. And so I'm so disappointed as to the way the Fisher family has interacted with the city and just let the team go to shambles. I mean, they're a 4A team. They're not a major league team. They've abandoned the city, and certainly they've had issues with trying to build the stadium, et cetera. I'll never understand why they didn't try to do a complex at the existing piece of property that they have there now along Highway 880, where the Oakland Coliseum was, with basketball, where the football team played, et cetera. I know that Mark Davis did not want to go to Vegas, even though he got a bucket of money to go over there. He wanted to stay there. He's born there. And could you have gotten Joe Lacob and the Warriors to stay with the A's, with the Raiders? I think it should have been done that way. I'll go to myself. I was high bidder for the A's. I have a letter in writing. This is dated December 27, 2004. That says I have a $25 million bid higher than any bid that you will receive. And at that time, there was no bid. Bud said that he would take care of me. I'll take care of this. I'll see this through for you, Reggie. Connect with me. I will help you get and own a team. Anyway, I went through him, and come to find out, all of a sudden, the team went to Lou Wolf, who was a prop for the Fisher family. Bud chased down the money from the Gap family. And I don't know what the promises were that were made, but I was kept out, pushed out, and had my money from a family in Las Vegas, the Greenspan family, and it just. You know, I had that $165 million and I could bid to $195. We had the team resold to some of the tech guys over in Silicon Valley. So we were going to make money. But it certainly would not, that team would not look like it does today, which really is an embarrassment to Major League Baseball, an embarrassment to Oakland, an embarrassment to the Fisher family. There is no winner there now. And so it'll go to Vegas. It'll immediately be worth $1 billion to $1.5 billion. Is it worth creating a rotten reputation for $1 billion? Because they probably, they paid $100 million in cash, $40 million of debt. So certainly if, and I think they're in it somewhere around 300 or more, 350, if you will. But they get a subsidy from, you know, one of the have-nots, if you will, like revenue sharing, is what, and it's, you know, they've traded all their players. They traded the guy that Atlanta hit 50 homers, and they traded an all-star third baseman to, I want to say to Toronto. Now he's with the Giants. I can't think of his name, but,
Chapman and Olsen.
Yeah, hell of a player. They traded a couple of good pitchers away, but it's not how the game should be. And there were, what do I want to say, commissioners before that penalized owners when they penalized Charlie Finley for selling players and getting rid of players. They rescinded all those and reversed all those deals during the free agency in 1976 when Fingers and Vida and Rudy got sold to the Red Sox and the Yankees. Campanaris was in that, and Bowie Kuhn rescinded. Yep. Yeah, he reversed all that stuff. So it's a terrible situation. It's absolutely not good for baseball. And so I'm disappointed. My feelings are hurt. I was pushed out. I was screwed over, if you will. By the game.
Well, you know, I do want to reminisce later about my childhood and your heyday as a ball player, but I'm going to make Joel happy and follow up. Why do you think you were? What's the theory that you were screwed over? Now, you say your money came from a Greenspan family in Las Vegas. You would have moved the team to Las Vegas, too, I assume.
Yes. We had in our minds to go to Las Vegas if that was necessary. At the same time, you have to take a look, and it's a group decision. It's not like my decision or one person or one group. Okay, you have to connect with the city. You've got to connect with Major League Baseball. You've got to do what's best. And so, for me, the conversations I would have had with the Warriors, very capable financially, the Raiders, not capable financially. Okay. They struggled, lost money while they were in Oakland, but there needed to be a conversation between state government, city government, different influential people. You've got Silicon Valley, 25 miles away across the bay, and you have 5, 6, 7 guys over there that are $1 trillion guys. 3-4 billion for a team is a rounding number. every day when the stock, Apple has 15 billion shares. The stock goes up a dime. It's $1.5 billion that day. That's the rounding number. So you could get help. You could have significant conversations that have to do with community. You have a minority community here. You have the people in the state that you got taxes that are coming. There's a lot going on here with three teams. You're going to lose all three teams. So those are the types of conversations at very high levels that you have. Did the Fisher family have them? I don't know. I tried several times to re-engage with them after they bought the team. The last time I connected with them, about maybe a year ago, I offered $300 million for 20% of the team. 20 to 25% is what my number, what my comment was, you know, and basically at 25% of the team, you could wind up just getting a suite and go to the game because you have no say. Because the other 75%. So that's where I am with that. That's where I was with that. It's awkward and difficult, John, at times when I talk about it, because it's an ugly mark, I believe, on the game. I'm part of it. It's bad. It's not good. I mean, there's things going on now in the game that are ugly marks, scars. And so do I need to make mention of them? Not really. We know what they are. I mean, so, exactly. It's just your expressions now speak volumes. You know, it's like, what do we do? It's not good. Am I going to, what do I have to say? It's not good. It's not good for leadership. It's not good for the game, et cetera.
You know, you mentioned awkward, uncomfortable. My sense is, John and I really got to know you in the period where you were working in a similar job you have now. You were an advisor to the Yankees for a long period of time. And it felt like maybe the end there was awkward and uncomfortable also. But you also mentioned earlier in this interview that you still kind of bleed pinstripes. How do you feel about the Yankees and your time there and your not time there?
I loved my time there. At times it was difficult, if you will. I will always have wonderful, not conflicted. I'll always have wonderful memories of the Yankees and my association with the Steinbrenner family, from Jenny to Jesse to Hal to Hank to George. The mom, Joan, was great to me. I was one of her favorites. And so I honestly have always felt a family relationship with the Steinbrenners. I feel like I could go back there tomorrow if I pick up the phone and call Hal. Those are my feelings there, Joe. I root against them when they're playing the Astros, but I don't root against them very much any other time. That's for sure. And I pull for Judge and I pull for Glaber and the guys that I know. I did get to meet Garrett Cole, and he's a class act. I sent him a message when he got hurt. Too bad good guys get hurt too. But it's a special place for me. And the same people that are there all the time, and whether it's the guys that are running the stadium, there's a couple car collectors over there that I know guys that, one guy collects Porsches. He's head of security. I can't think of his name right now. But, and then of course the big guy that used to work for George and is one of the security guys. I'm stumbling here with the names.
I think Eddie is the guy who does the cars, right?
Eddie Fasthook. And there's minority gentleman that runs security for the
Sunny
state.
Sunny Hyde.
Just beautiful people that feel like family.
I had one question here that was called in by my wife before we went on here. She wanted to know, why aren't you with the Yankees anymore? It seems weird you're with the Astros to many of us. What happened?
You know, I got to the point to where for a couple of years, I was not participating with what was going on with the team. And, you know, in my interactions and conversations with Brian, we couldn't get on the same level, couldn't get on the same wavelength. And so rather than us bump heads any longer, and we really weren't really communicating very much for a couple of years, I never really had input with what the roster would look like or what our minor league system would look like, players that we would look for to fill gaps, if you will. And it's not like I needed to have decisions that final decisions on anything, but certainly I wanted to have input and leave the content that I had throughout our system, throughout our what we were doing offensively, et cetera. In fact, in the 90s, I was involved in writing the approach at home plate with Bob Watson and a few other guys throughout the system that we, you know, we worked on things. And so I was involved in that way of how we were going to teach and train our coming players, because I was always wanted to be part of, okay, our third baseman is Urshela. Who's going to be the next third baseman 5 years from now? You know, our second baseman is Glaber. Who's going to be the next guy? And so I wanted to be a part of that in the minor league system. I spent more time in the minor leagues than I did in the major leagues. Now I spend more time in the major leagues than I do in the minor leagues. And that doesn't matter to me. It's harder to work in the major leagues than it is to work in the minor leagues. You know, that's for sure, because, you know, the birds down there are baby robins, and they're always searching for any kind of thing that you would feed them, if that makes sense. And what happened, John, in getting back is, you know, nobody had any interest in what I had to say about free agents or about players or about the organization. And I thought it was time to leave. I had I flew to Tampa to talk to Hal. He understood. And he constantly insisted, Reggie, we want you to stay here. We want you to stay here. You say you're leaving. We want you to stay here. That's basically what he fought for. He asked me if I would talk to Brian. I did talk to Brian, and our conversation was not really awkward, but he understood my side. I understood his, and we walked away. And I never got to the point to where I made an announcement about leaving, et cetera. I just kind of wanted it to go away because I didn't want it to have any inflammation in it.
Well, it's weird to us New Yorkers that you're an Astro now. It does feel like you have a great relationship with the owner, Jim Crane, and do have input in what goes on there. So a couple of things I was going to ask you about were, you know, what happened with Snell? We all thought that maybe Snell would be an Astro. And also, Bregman is a free agent. What do you everyone seems to think he's going to be a free agent and that his price is going to be too high and the Astros aren't going to be able to pay it. So if you could cover those two things, Snell and Bregman, I'd be interested.
You know, I think that, again, you know, we have a great leadership group in our with our GM. Also, we have a couple of other advisors in Craig Biggio and Jeff Bagwell, who are very much involved in our decision making. I'm involved. Jim takes those decisions and puts them together, listens to our management and coaching staff on the field. Talks to our GM and his staff. And then, of course, some of the analytics come into the future of a player, and our decisions are made that way, along with being fiscally responsible. Our being fiscally responsible, I think, is what kicked us out of the Snell deal. He signed a 2-year deal, I want to say, for 62. That's too much for him. He's been hurt a couple of times. And I think there's incentives on top of that. He's also got an option on his own. And between the 4 or 5 people that make the decisions with the Astros, we don't play that game. We don't want our players to be paid out of the proper scale, if you will. We have a Hall of Famer who signed a 5-year extension for $125 million. It takes him up to being 38 years old. And we thought that was fair. It may have been a year or two too long, but he certainly earned it. He's the face of the franchise. That's Altuve. And so are we going to be able to keep Tucker? Are we going to be able to keep Bregman? We hope so. But we're not going to go beyond Jim's fiscal responsibility to the team and its budget. We're at the top right now in reference to the tax. We have a small tax that we have to pay. And then the understanding of that is, you know, I understand it's 100% plus 10, 20, 30% at times. So it gets to the point to where it doesn't fit. And so we go other ways. And that's done by really our owner that manages this thing with fiscal responsibility.
Well, you know, this has been a real treat, and I appreciate you going overtime. I did have one final question. This is the 50th anniversary of Hank Aaron breaking the home run record. Home run number 715 came on April 8th, 1974, 50 years ago today. As we do this, I certainly recall it. You were a major league star already at this point. What do you recall of that, and what does Hank Aaron mean to you?
Boy, Hank Aaron is a special guy. That's one of the reasons that I wore number 44. And I joined the Yankees wearing number 20. I don't know if you know that, but there are photos with me with the number 20 on. I wore it because of Frank Robinson had been such an important piece for me in the Winter League that year. And then, so I wore it in his honor. Then in spring training, the guy that wore number 44, Fred Whitfield, I think, got either sold to Japan or traded to the Giants. And I saw the number, and I thought of Hank Aaron, and I thought of Willie McCovey. And Willie had been instrumental in mentoring me as in my early years, 68, 970, over in Arizona. And so I took the number because of that. And then, of course, Hank Aaron was the guy that led us, led so well black players. He really was the guy that took over for Jackie Robinson because he got so much attention. And at the same time, certainly we all know that whether it was McCovey or Billy Williams or Ernie Banks or Bob Gibson or Juan Marichal or Bobby Clemente, the great Roberto Clemente, they all had done things for improving what the minorities were doing and Latin American players, et cetera. But, you know, Henry to me was the guy that spoke about the issues of being a minority, spoke about the difficulties of being successful as a black man. And so, you know, Henry Aaron stood for all those things for me. I got to meet Jackie Robinson. I got to meet and introduce his wife one day when she was honored in New York. And I always thought that Jackie Robinson's wife, Rachel, was an angel that walked on earth. I'd introduced her as a person that is proof of angels walk on earth with us. And then, of course, Jackie was such a special person. I could never have done that. I was too emotional, too volatile, you know, to be able to have managed myself that way in the way he did by just turning the other cheek, if you will. So, you know, John, when you ask the question, it gives an in-depth answer. It's one that makes me think. It brings tears and joy at the same time because of what Hank Aaron meant to me and still means to me and will continue to.
Rich, I'm going to wrap it. Last question here. I'm going to mention, I hate that John's lovely wife, Corinne, has asked the best question so far of this interview. that's really debilitating to me and John. But a couple of days ago, a scout I really like said something interesting. He said, Jim Crane is our George Steinbrenner. He said he woke up one day and he wanted Josh Hader and he got Josh Hader. He said he doesn't seem to give a damn about the rankings of the minor league systems. If you're going to use the minor leaguers to make sure the team in the major leagues keeps being special. And that was before I knew we were going to have you on. And I said to myself, you know, next time I see Reggie, I want to ask somebody who knows both guys well, if he sees anything there. Is there some George Steinbrenner in Jim Crane in this desire to kind of like chase it no matter what to win?
Jim Crane is all about winning. He's all about community. He's about people. And he is a great leader. And the reason I say that is because he includes people. He has people around him that are smart, diligent, loyal. And his crew of about five or six people are always with him and have been there ever since I've known Jim. And I've known Jim for going on 20 years when I was trying to buy the A's, when I was trying to buy the Dodgers. I met Jim at Pebble Beach because he has a home out there. And he was trying to buy the Cubs and trying to buy the Rangers 20-some years ago. So we became friends then. And developed a respect for each other and a friendship, excuse me, to where I would say he has a great understanding of people and a great knack about how to run business. I think the fact that he knows how to treat people and knows how to use people that are around him is what makes him so successful. So, yes, he has some George Steinbrenner in him. George was in the same fashion of understanding how to get things out of people and how to surround himself with people, although George kind of overspent, had a few too many people around and a few too many people, but he just had excess. George didn't really have a budget. He just said, you know, we'll make the money, just spend it, and, you know, we'll get what we want. But your analysis of Crane, of Jim Crane, Jim is more concise and a little, and more, not a little, but more exacting when it comes to understanding people and his path of pursuit of becoming a champion, becoming a winner. He wants to win three championships and have the most in the city of Houston. He wants to have a diverse workforce with all of his companies. And so I help him with that. And that's very important to me. He wants to make his community in Houston a better place to live and for people to function. And that's important to him. He constantly tells me, Reggie, how are you going to maintain the success of your foundation? It's fine while you're alive, but when you're not, you're going to need the money to be able to continue to sustain it. And he cracks the whip on me about making it continue to be successful.
Well, Reggie, you know, in the introduction, I mentioned, you know, the width of your career, the span of your career, five championships on the field, another championship in the front office with the Astros. We knew we weren't going to get to everything, but John and I appreciate so much the time you did give us here on the show with Joel Sherman and John Heyman.
Well, you know, John and Joe, you guys have been friends since I knew you when you were kids.
And so, that just shows how long the relationship is, right?
I think I'm 20 years older than both of you. Are you no. over 50, 55?
You're a very nice person.
63. Yeah,
And Joe, how old are you?
I turned 60 a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, okay. Well, I know that I'm older than you guys, but a generation, but I also know that you're way more than sports writers to me. You're people that I enjoy and people that I enjoy sitting with at any time. I saw John in Houston and he was walking, getting ready to go to bed. And I was sitting there by myself watching TV. I said, "Hey, man, come on over and just sit with me." And we had a great conversation for about 30 minutes. And then I got myself, I walked into this show here. So he hit me up. We had a good meeting. We had some fun right. together. And so he got me all supple, eased up.
I didn't even pay for your dinner. You usually probably get $100,000 for something like this. And so I actually made a good deal with you. So I'm very proud of that.
It's enjoyable for me.
Thanks so much, Reggie. All the best.
All right, buddy. Take care.
All right. Thanks, Reggie.
John and I, of course, thank Reggie Jackson for joining us. John, hit or error?
I'm going to give a hit out to Anthony Volpe. 209 last year, and let's not denigrate his year. He did win a Gold Glove. He became the second shortstop after Derek Jeter to go 20-20. He had a nice rookie season. The Yankees hung with them. I give them credit. He did hit 209. Right now, as we do this, he's leading the American League in batting at 424. So he has adjusted. He doesn't want to get into whether it's the coach, this, that, the other. That's fine. He's a nice guy. He's a great guy. He doesn't want to blame anybody. He's obviously flattened out his swing, improved, and he's a great story at the beginning of this year.
Yeah, I was at the game yesterday. Johnny was the best player on the field. It was like, my basketball analogies. He was like he had a triple-double. He made the best defensive play of the game. He had three hits, and he had two stolen bases. He dominated the game.
I read the column.
Thank you, John. There is one person still doing that. Look, for my hit, I'm going to tell my favorite Reggie Jackson story because Reggie was our guest. So we're in Minnesota during the playoffs, and it's the workout day. And, he's Reggie Jackson. He's not wearing a credential like the rest of the people are. And an over-officious security guard who probably doesn't know anything about baseball history comes up to him with a clipboard and says, sir, you're not wearing your credential. Like, who are you? Are you on the list? And he goes, yeah, I'm probably on the list. And he goes, what's your last name? And Reggie looks at him and goes, October. And the guy goes, and you could see the guy looking down the list, and he goes, I don't see it. He goes, what's your first name? He goes, Mister.
That's Reggie.
And at that point, as great as the moment is, and as much as I like things like The Office and Curb Your Enthusiasm and uncomfortable moments, I had to break in to explain to the security guard it was Reggie Jackson. And he was okay. You could probably go to there. I said, there's the Yankees media relations guy. Go ask him if he's okay to be here. But yes, that's my favorite Reggie Jackson story. What's your last name, October? What's your first name, Mister?
Beautiful. That's Reggie. He's the best. Yes,
that's Reggie. John, do your thing. Thank our producers.
Oh, thank to Jake Brown and Dan Shalom. They do a great job every week, and we so appreciate them.
We got a shtick now, John. yes, thank you to our producers, Dan and Jake. I should just do that, right? Dan and Jake, I could get through it for producing the show. Don't forget, the show drops on the New York Post YouTube page. Go check us out. Also, Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, give us a 5-star rating, leave a review. And John, we're off and running a couple of weeks into the season. Please continue to listen to us on the show with Joel Sherman and John Heyman.